Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
I always wait to say hi, Dan, until call recorder engages and ticks off 1 second, because I don't want to get cut off at the beginning of our conversation. It's also exactly the amount of time that the little beep sound plays in the final edit, so it's just kind of as a coincidence. And I bring this up mostly because this week we discovered that Call Recorder, the app that we use to record this very podcast, will not be updated to support Apple Silicon. So the writing is on the wall for a tool that I think a lot of us Mac podcast people have been using for more than a decade now.
Jeez, that long? Yeah, it was like late 2000s.
Yeah.
Somewhere in there.
Yeah, I mean, they said it was 13 years old, I think, the app.
That sounds about right. Yeah. I was going to say, I mean, while this will have an impact, I'm not yet sure how much of an impact it will have on my usual podcast recording because I record on an Intel iMac, which I'm probably not replacing. Although I did have the thought this week that if Apple launched an Apple Silicon iMac this year, I know my mom's iMac has gotten a little long in the tooth, so I could just give her this iMac and have all Apple Silicon. But maybe, I don't know. We'll see. Anyways, it is, you know, I've shifted away from Call Recorder for most stuff. I still use it, but it's always like the backup now. It's not my primary audio file. It's pretty, that's usually an audio hijack file now.
Right. I'm working
but
on
it's great because it's so, it is so bulletproof.
It's automatic.
Right? Yeah.
And you can, I'm working on a piece about this that should be up today because I'm writing it now. I just stopped to do this call about sort of like what happens when a tool that you use dies, like more broadly. And it's true. The way I use Audio Hijack, it used to be the only way to do it. And, you know, I just, it was it. I used it. That was it. And yes, Call Recorder. And Audio Hijack came in and, like, sniped a lot of Call Recorder stuff. But I always kept Call Recorder running because it's a great backup. And the truth is, so many people I talk to, they're not spending the money on Audio Hijack, right? In fact, in the early days, what I did is I bought essentially a site license. I bought a bunch of seats of Call Recorder and gave them out to incomparable panelists because, like, you have a Mac, you're using Skype, install this. And all of those people, you know, that's where it's going to hurt because it's going to be like, okay, we need to either use something else or we're going to need. But the truth is also we've also shifted away from Skype, right? Like so much of what I do is already in Zoom. Although what I found, and this is going to be part of this piece that I'm writing, sometimes your devotion to the workflows that you've built up over the years, I mean, you can call it inertia if you want to, or the status quo. Sometimes it takes the removal of one piece of the puzzle for you to reflect on the larger whole.
It's a Jenga situation.
I don't think we've decided anything, but I definitely had a conversation with Mike Hurley and Stephen Hackett where I sent them that link. And I think all of us were like, so Zoom? Like, was Call Recorder the only reason we were still using Skype? Because Skype isn't very good. There is no perfect voice over IP app.
What it had going for it for a long time was that everyone had it. And now, in the last year, Zoom has exploded in popularity to the point where it's also ubiquitous. So that kind of chipped away at one of the last things that Skype had going for
Skype
it.
Is was free. Just like, it's
yeah,
free.
It was free and had a universal user base.
Free is good. There are lots of tools out there. Just to preempt people, I'm aware of most of them. I did have a couple people write in to me when I wrote about Call Recorder. I said, well, here's the solution. It's like, no, it's not.
I cracked it for you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, somebody sent me, there are a few web apps out there, and web apps are nice, although they don't work on mobile and they don't work in Safari. Generally, they only work with Chrome and Firefox. And a lot of those web apps, I mean, none of them are free, and that's fine. Zoom's not free either. And I pay for Zoom. I pay an annual subscription for Zoom, and it's, you know, Zoom as a product is, as a Mac piece of Mac software isn't very good, but as a service, it's spectacularly good. It does so much and so much more than so many of the other things that are out there. But those web services, they're pretty good for limited groups of people. Like, you could use it for Clockwise or something like that. And they're also not free, although the one that was recommended to me this week is like $600 a year or something. And I'm like, no. No.
Even those, I mean, even like I used Zencastr a couple times. I used it for one of the Mandalorian shows I did, and I used it for an episode of Biff, the superhero show that I do on The Incomparable, where John Maltz was having a Skype problem.
Right.
And it just, for some reason, we could not hear him. I'm like, look, you know what? We'll just try this. And honestly, as I said to you the other day when we were talking about this in Slack, if Zencastr and Safari played nicely together, I feel like I would have much less hesitation about it, but trying to, you know, dictate what browser people use, like, oh, you got to keep a separate browser around, and then you got to launch it just for that.
Well, I had to walk Tim Goodman through installing Chrome, and then I would send him the link, and I say, here is your Chrome link. And I would do that because it was like, you can't just open this in Safari. You have to go to Chrome and open
it
there.
And if you could, I would be on board with it, I feel like, 100% if it worked in Safari.
I've talked to some of those developers because somebody asked me if this was just sort of intransigence on the part of the developers of the web apps. And my understanding is that although Apple did finally add some support for the technologies that they use to do real-time communication, RTC, it's called WebRTC, it is... I believe Apple doesn't support the codec, the sort of like the audio encoding format that all of these tools use and that all the other browsers support. It's some open source Opus or whatever. And I think Apple just never supported that. And I don't know, that was like a year or two ago when I checked. And I don't actually know if that's still the holdup or if there's something else or if they've just all moved on. But like, I'll tell you, if Apple supported this, I think they would be motivated to make it work because it is a support issue for them.
Yeah,
and
sure.
it would bring in a lot more more users. And I suspect it might even make it work on iPads and iPhones if Apple supported it right. But I think that they can't crack that nut. And so that's a tricky one. There are no good options here. But, you know, the larger point is it does make you reconsider. And I think this is what I'm trying to do in my piece, too, is talk about, like, you have a workflow and you build it up. And it's not just one tool, right? I'm using the word bricolage, which I learned because it was the name of our CMS at Macworld. But
that's
bricolage,
right, it was.
Bricolage is like, it's like what a beaver dam is or a bird's nest. It is a assortment of stuff that's kind of like assembled into a thing. And that's what human workflows, especially computer workflows, tend to be, is it's this tool and this tool and this tool and this file format and this thing I get over here and this app I use over here, and you kind of assemble it, and then you can change it. And with Zoom is a good example where people were really grumbly when I started saying we're going to use Zoom for The Incomparable, but like I felt like there was enough of a benefit there and to get over the hump and get people to change. But sometimes an app goes away, or a utility or a service or whatever, and you don't get to make the choice of here's a benefit. Instead, it's like, oh god, I have to change everything because this thing is going away or has gone away. And, you know, you can say, yeah, well, just don't upgrade and don't buy an Apple Silicon Mac and you can use Call Recorder forever. And it's like, well, yeah, but eventually you're going to have to choose that eventually. And not to upgrade is a choice. You're going to be turning your back on a lot of stuff and potentially have security issues after a year or two. And so that's part of the issue here, is that it is a different feeling. And anybody who's been through it, you know, it is frustrating because you didn't get to make the case that a change is good. Instead, a change was forced upon you. It doesn't mean it's still not an opportunity. And when you remove that, like, you know, in my conversation with Mike and Steven, you do immediately start to question things that were before just sort of like inviolate. Like, well, I'm not going to change this tool because it's part of the whole thing. And now you're like, well, we broke the seal on the whole thing by removing this tool. So at that point, let's just revisit everything.
Right, and there's also opportunity there, I think, from like, well, you know, we could never do X because the product didn't support it, and because we weren't changing that product, we can't do X.
Exactly.
And all of a sudden you've changed. You're like, well, I guess X is actually possible now. Like, you know, that's, I think that's an interesting, I mean, you know, something like, wow, you know, all right, we're using Zoom. I guess we could kind of have like almost like an audience like on Zoom, right? Like, you know, there's just like, not that you would necessarily do that, but like it opens up doors that maybe are things that you could not do before.
Mm-hmm.
And I always think that is interesting. I mean, I am still on Skype more than most people because all of the shows with the exception of Total Party Kill and, you know, whenever, you know, some of the other incomparable shows.
Yep.
The Rebound, Biff, and Clockwise, which are the, and this, the four shows I record pretty much every week are all still on Skype right now. And, you know, that will probably start to shift, I'm guessing, in the next year or so.
I think so.
You know, again, Skype for a long time was one of those things where it's like, it's the worst, except for everything else. And now that's kind of Zoom. Zoom is now the worst, except for everything else. And, you know, set aside, as you said before, their product is great. Their company has some issues.
Yeah.
But it still does a nice job. And, you know, to the point where when we do, you know, when I do Inconceivable on the Incomparable or we do Total Party Kill, obviously, like, it's proved pretty good. And like you and I have wrestled with a lot of the stuff for streaming.
Oh boy.
And making Zoom work with that for video streaming. And again, it's like this thing where it's like, there are better ways for this to work.
Yeah.
But the problem is nothing is a better solution. Like just across the board, right? There's no brainer.
Yeah. Skype is actually better at live video streaming than Zoom is for some
ironically
reasons.
Yes.
It's very strange. And maybe Zoom will get there, but yeah, you're right. I would change from Zoom. I mean, I did a lot of research. This is before everybody just was told that Zoom was a thing that everybody in the world should use in March of last year, right?
Mm-hmm.
I did, like 2 years ago, I did a whole bunch of research. I'd been using Zoom for a video call for a nonprofit that I was on the board of. And, but then I was aware of it because I'd done research for that, actually. And I did more research about the podcast thing, trying to find the best solution. And Zoom, you know, the short version of why Zoom, for people who are wondering, is that Zoom will let me record a podcast session and I get a file for every voice on that podcast, a separate file for every voice, which for editing purposes is spectacularly important because that's how you can edit podcasts, is if people interrupt each other, you can remove some of the voices from it and then the interruption disappears, and that's how podcast editing works. And previously with Skype, all I get access to is my voice and a track with everybody's voice on it. So if somebody's recording fails, somebody forgot to press record or whatever, the computer crashes, it becomes a huge job to try and pick apart what they say while other people are also going on top of it, and it's very bad. And Zoom solves that. It's not a pristine recording, which would be perfect. It's a cloud recording, so it's got artifacts and stuff like that. It's pretty good. It's pretty good. I would toss Zoom away in a heartbeat if there was something that fulfilled all those issues, you know, and all those needs better.
Right.
But although there are other alternatives that do some of what Zoom does and even better, they all have their own limitations. Like, for example, the web things tend to be like four people only because on bandwidth connections, low bandwidth connections, they break apart. And then some of the ones that are really nice are really super expensive, like six times as expensive, seven times as expensive as Zoom. And that's an issue too. So like there's with time limits on top of it, which is just bananas. Yeah. Like Zoom,
I was really,
you buy it and you just use it forever.
Really impressed for a bit with Zencastr because currently during the COVID, they removed both their guest and time limits.
Yeah.
And it's basically free except for if you want like a wave instead of an MP3.
It's good. And it's a good product. It is. It's going to break down if you have seven people on. If you have a draft on the Incomparable with 10 people, it's not going to work. But it is pretty great. And like Clockwise could use that if you wanted to, especially if you broadened your guest list where you've got people who don't really know what they're doing, because that's the beauty of some of these tools, is that you no longer have to hold their hand and say, this is how you record your microphone and then you need to send it to me. Does it all, but this is my big point, right? Which is, and this is applicable even if you're not a Mac podcaster, which most of you were probably not, is there is an opportunity. It's so frustrating when something breaks or is going to break. You know that the clock is ticking. It can be an opportunity. It is overwhelming at times, right? Because it's like, oh no, like pull that thread and the whole thing unravels. But it is potentially an opportunity to make change that you, like you said, Dan, previously thought impossible because this other tool like made it impossible. And now with that tool out of the equation, it's like, oh, there's any number of things that we could do here. And it's exciting, but it's also frustrating. I also want to put this in the context, and somebody tweeted at me the other day about this, and it was funny because I'd been thinking about this for a couple of years now, which is there's so many apps that I use that are by people, by like a person.
Right.
And I I was thinking about this because my friend Greg Noss posted in the Incomparable Slack about how, you know, he's 15 years-ish from retirement, right? And I thought, oh, a friend of mine from college is now doing, like, not immediate, but, like, gauging retirement age. I thought, oh boy, that's where I am now. I'm 50 years old. That's where I am now. But a lot of the people I know who write the software I rely on are about my age or even a little bit older. And I have those thoughts of like, what's going to happen? Right? I mean, one of the great things about indie apps, indie software, is that they're from often individuals or very small groups. And nothing lasts forever. But like BBEdit has lasted nearly forever and pCalc has lasted nearly forever. Yeah. But like if Rich Siegel, you know, and I love Rich, I hope Rich is going to be fine. But if Rich, I was going to say get hit by a bus, but like if Rich retires, he's like, I'm done. I'm sure he'd probably like try to find a, you know, a way.
Sell it.
I'm sure. Yeah. And I, you know, whatever. But like, I have those moments now where I'm like, that's going to start happening probably, is that the people who make the tools that I've relied on for 20 years are just going to say, I'm out.
Yeah.
And well, that's going to force a change.
I don't want to categorize it as a labor of love because it's something they're doing for money, but it is something that they have love. It's a product they have love for and have labored over.
Somebody else is going to feel that way.
Yeah. And I mean, we saw this, actually a great example of this is NetNewsWire. Right, because that changed hands a bunch of times after Brent decided that he was, you know, he went off to work for NewsGator, right? And then he decided he wasn't doing NetNewsWire, and it got sold to at least one, if not two different people.
Right.
And eventually, you know, he came back and decided to start working on it again.
Yeah, as an open source project.
Right, and it's like, that's great. I mean, and Brent is the person, clearly, who has cared more about that product than anybody else.
But only Brent would have ever done that, right?
Yes,
literally.
Exactly.
And if he doesn't care...
Exactly.
Now he's...
And I will say...
I think Brent is smart because... I mean, I know Brent is smart, but in this way, I think Brent is very, very smart because Brent is building an open source community and team around NetNewsWire.
Right.
And the idea there is that he is trying to remove himself as an essential tool in the bricolage of NetNewsWire, right? He's trying to make it like, if I step away, the community continues and maybe people have to step up, but it's not going to be just like, I'm gone and it's gone. And I think that why he's doing that.
It's an interesting point too, because if you want to like contrast that to a different approach. Also, Brent developed Mars Edit, which he then sold to our friend Daniel Jalkut, who has been now working on it for more than a decade.
And now I rely on that, so I hope Bell doesn't retire.
But it's funny because, you know, Brent decided he could spin that off, sort of, and Daniel decided he, you know, clearly Daniel has a passion for that software, right? Because he's been now invested in it for a decade. So, you know, sometimes that can work. Sometimes you can find somebody who's like aligned with, you know, if not your vision, at least like feels equally passionately about a product.
Yeah.
And that's great.
Yeah,
but you can't depend on it.
No, and it can be scary if it's something that you... I mean, this is how I felt not too long ago when I discovered that the guy who wrote Bitbar, which I use in my menu bar and I love, he wrote it like a long time ago. And I wrote about it on Six Colors, and 2 days later it got posted to Hacker News, and he got this huge influx of users. And I can't prove it, but I think basically I did that. I think the timing is suspicious otherwise. But he was always interested in other stuff and has a real job, and it was never, you know, he had other career things to do. Focusing a lot of time maintaining that app was not really something he wanted to do. And that had been going on, it turns out, for like a year or two. And I didn't know it because I don't visit the GitHub repository for Bitbar. I just use it. And what happened was Big Sur came out. Bitbar looked bad in Big Sur. I went to the website to see if there were issues or, you know, what was going on, and discovered that it had sort of been abandoned. And there were people who were filing all these bugs, but the guy hadn't been listening to them, and somebody had done a build that sort of worked better with Big Sur, but it was just sort of a random fork of it. And I thought, oh no, this is like, I don't have a problem with the guy because he wrote that software and gave it away and I love it. It's not his responsibility to maintain it forever. I'm not entitled to his attention to update that software forever, or anybody's, quite honestly. But it did have that moment where I'm like, oh no, like I rely on this thing and it's going to die and what's going to happen? And I had that moment of like, what is this gonna do? And it turns out somebody wrote basically a new version of the same thing in Swift called SwiftBar, and is very actively building it and maintaining it. And I'm using that now. And I think if that hadn't happened, maybe the BitBar guy with Big Sur, he was showing signs of probably trying to get some, you know, contributors to fix it up and take it away from him so that he didn't have to do it, but that the community could do it. But he had sort of let it go. You know, my point being that, like, sometimes that happens where you see the writing on the wall and you realize that this thing is just not going to come back, and you have to, it's, I don't know, it's tough. This is one of the reasons I like user automation, because at least I can, in some cases, write my own little bits to connect things together. But, you know, this is in the computer world, in the tech world, nothing is forever, right? The software changes, the APIs get deprecated. Apple is really aggressive about sort of throwing things away. All the 32-bit apps that got thrown away and Catalina, like, it happens. And if it's something you rely on, like I had a Twitter exchange with Don Giller, who's the guy who recorded and then digitized every David Letterman show.
Right.
And he was talking about how he had to retrieve from this old audio tape, this old thing from the 60s that he found that was, you know, long story, but he was going to post it. And he mentioned that he used Peak, the audio editor, the deprecated, like, discontinued Peak. I used to use Peak to do all of this. And I wrote to him and I said, well, if you're looking for a modern replacement, it's Sound Studio is essentially identical to Peak. It goes back to, it's a long lineage that goes all the way back to Sound Edit back in the classic Mac days. Mm-hmm. And his response, though, and the point of this story is that his response was, I'm on Snow Leopard.
Ha!
And I thought, well, that's right. I knew that he's using a cheese grater, old cheese grater, on Snow Leopard, and all of his software is of that vintage. And my response was, well, if you're on Snow Leopard, just keep using Peak, right?
Right. It's, yeah. Just, if it works,
you can do that. But I also get that that's your alternative. Is basically, I'm going to just keep. I think his Mac Pro died at some point, and he just got another one on eBay because, like, he doesn't want to go to the present day. And, you know, that's fine. That's fine. But that's your alternative when your stuff abandons you.
Yeah. Well, it reminded me of, I interviewed, what was his name, Bob Stack, who did New Yorker covers once when I was at Macworld.
I remember that.
And he did, you know, he was using some old version of Illustrator,
right?
Like on an old Mac. And it's like, he's like, yeah, it works fine. I don't really have a problem with it. I was like, fair enough. You know, like,
you know, George R. R. Martin writes in WordStar.
Right, WordStar, yeah, right.
On DOS.
We had this conversation on the Rebound a little bit ago. I think, I don't remember why it came up, but we started talking about ClarisWorks and AppleWorks documents and having those sitting around. I think somebody asked us a question about what, like, do we worry about losing old data, you know, essentially when the apps die that are associated with that data. And for a long time, you could still open ClarisWorks and AppleWorks documents and pages. And then when Apple redid all of iWork to sort of, you know, create that new underlying infrastructure so it was kind of the same on iOS and macOS, it lost that ability. And now you can't even open the old version of pages anymore. Yeah. So
I remember...
Yeah, it's fine.
I remember... what was it? I think it was PageMaker, where I had all these old PageMaker files, and InDesign came out, and it turned out that you could do, and I think maybe Word used to do this too, the chain of document updates. So you've got a PageMaker 3 file, but if you open that in PageMaker 5, it'll convert. And then a PageMaker 5 file will open PageMaker 6. And then InDesign 1 will open PageMaker 6. And then InDesign 3 will open InDesign 1. And there was this chain where you could, like, open the document up 4 or 5 times and get it to run in the modern thing. Yeah.
So maybe somebody should just spend the time writing a file converter.
Right?
I don't know. But no, who's going to do that?
But who's going to do that?
Again, it's only somebody who cares that much about it and has the requisite knowledge, and that's always the trick.
This is a total tangent, but, you know, it's this podcast. It can happen. Somebody sent me a link to, I think it was Ben Long, who writes about photography stuff, wrote at Macworld for a long time. Ben sends me wacky links about old computers. That's basically what Ben does. And he sent me a link about a guy who was trying to get this game that he wrote for the Apple II off of a floppy disk, but the floppy disk was corrupted.
Oh, no.
And it's amazing because he has to research what the Apple ProDOS floppy disk format was. Because he can read the individual sectors of the disk, but he doesn't know what they mean. And so then, so he does this thing, and the format is bizarre. Like, you're like, who did this? But it is documented. And he actually, like, copied...
Steve Wozniak, probably.
Well, ProDOS was later, but it, again, and they had their reasons. And it's like, the blocks in regular DOS, are Apple soft DOS, are like... block size on the disk, and then the ProDOS blocks are double size, and the way that they're structured is weird, and you're like, why? And it's probably something to do with the hardware of the disks and the disk seeking. And he unravels this whole thing and copies it allows him to copy data from a good disk into the places where the corruption happens on the bad disk. And he has to do, it's amazing because he goes through all the steps. So you find the disk format, you figure out what the file format is, what the files on the disk are, patch the holes, and then see if it runs. And the answer is, it totally did run. Some of the graphics, and I use that term really loosely, were corrupted. But he was able to run this program that he wrote when he was, you know, probably 10 years old. But I just love the story of the forensics of that. That's, I think, an important part of computer history is going to be, you know, emulators and old software and understanding what the old APIs were or being able to reverse engineer them. And like, we shouldn't have to lose that stuff. Like, if you've got an old ClarisWorks file or whatever, like, you know, ideally you should be able to open it somewhere. But at the very least, I think it's going to be important for the future that everybody have access to that stuff. Somehow, just for historical purposes, if nothing else. And I hope that Mike and Stephen found this, it was on Connected a while ago, that they were hiring an archivist at Apple. And they're like, Stephen, I don't want to move to California. But I was thinking about it and thinking, you know, a librarian and archivist at Apple is important also because at some point, somebody needs to at the very least be maintaining the like source code and stuff for all the historical versions of this software, because that's important. Like that's super important. It still frustrates me that Apple has not officially released like the source and the ROMs and stuff for old Apple IIs and old Macs and stuff. And I get that they're probably like patent and licensing things in there, but it's so frustrating that it has to all be kind of reverse engineered instead of just coming from the source.
Kind of makes me think of like those, like the seed vaults, like that they have, you know, where it's like, we need a copy of these things just in case something bad happens and we need to replant stuff that now is extinct or whatever. But it is kind of, I think there is a digital argument for that, right? Like that there is, this material that's super old, and like people worry about that a lot of times with things like even media, like physical media, right? Like, well, you know, what if you store a CD for 100 years, but nobody has a CD player, or you know, these days, like, what if you have a laser disc? Well, I don't know. Like, what do you do with that?
Yeah.
And I think that's valid, but there's also the software side of it, I think, which is equally important, which is like, yeah, maybe the media hasn't degraded, but what if you can't understand it? And like in the software side, I think most of the time the answer is, you probably could figure out how to reverse engineer it given enough time and wherewithal, as opposed to a piece of media that's been degraded or essentially is unreadable.
But plain text, you can just read it. So
right, exactly. And that's what I think I said at the end of the day, even with like old ClarisWorks and AppleWorks files, is like they're not particularly readable, but if you open them in like BBEdit, you can at least get some text out of them. Like it's going to be a problem a lot of times, you can read it.
The other documents that I made in college that I can still read today, PDFs and PostScript files.
I was going to say that like PDF is the thing that I come back to a lot of times because I rarely come across a PDF that's been corrupted. They seem to be pretty, pretty good. And it is, you know, fundamentally just it's just, it's not just an image exactly, but like it, the format is impermeable in some ways.
Like
so,
PostScript,
you know.
It's literally the instructions to draw the
vectors,
what,
yeah.
A representation on the page. And also Adobe has been very motivated to say, essentially, PDF is like paper. Everybody should be able to see it. Everybody should be able to read it. And,
yeah,
and that's,
I mean,
why
it's,
I
it's
think...
the lingua franca, right?
Like, yeah. So I can open like a PDF that I made in 1991 in preview.
Sure.
And it,
yeah, exactly.
Is fine. And I have PDFs from 1991. I do. So, yeah, it's maybe there are PostScript files from 1991, PDFs from 1994 or something like that. But
I think I discussed this briefly because I was like trying to get some text out of my book for a book bundle that it was part of, out of my first book, and I realized I didn't have a copy of it that I could get text out of.
Right.
Which was, felt dumb. And eventually I found a workaround with a PDF copy, and even then I had to like reformat stuff because like it had line breaks in weird places because it was like essentially it's the print copy of the book,
right.
Like and that was a fun exercise in, but I wrote this, how come I can't get the text out of it?
Anyway, things fall apart, the center cannot hold, et cetera, et cetera.
indeed.
but view it as an opportunity, I guess. Look, change is inevitable, so view it as an opportunity to revisit what you're doing. And so for call recorder dying, that's what I'm trying to do, is like, look, it was already not as important as it used to be, and I think that's telling in part because things kind of moved along, but also in part because it was increasingly fighting a battle. Let's just say it. They were also fighting a battle with Skype. Skype kept updating and trying to basically remove it.
I do like that they had switched to essentially auto-updating it every time Skype updated now. And I was amused by that, but also like I'm sure that's maddening.
And I feel bad for them because I feel like they put in a lot of work to try to keep it working. And then the Apple Silicon thing, all I can think is that there's something very specific about Apple Silicon that is not worth the effort. Also, I'll point out Ecamm Network that does this, and we know those people, we know the guys who founded it, they're very nice guys. They have a like a big modern awesome live streaming app called Ecamm Live that is a subscription app, and it's for video streamers, and it's got all these amazing features, and it's Mac only, and it's beautiful. And it's very clear that that's that and not Skype call recorder is the future of their company.
Sure.
So I also kind of understand their decision. I feel bad because they have invested in like a new format and new tools and a bunch of other new stuff in call recorder the last few years to try to keep it alive, and I appreciate that they tried, but clearly it was the last straw, and they have bigger fish to fry. So I also am not going to get mad at them for killing it, because I understand, and again, they it's been good. And when they discontinue something, they put it in their Hall of Fame, which I love as a concept. So call recorders in the Hall of Fame, it's fine. There are other options, and it will probably be an opportunity for all of us to revisit what we do. And that, you know, I bought that app 10 years ago and haven't paid for it since, because it's all been free updates. So thank you to them for all of that they did. And now it's over.
Yeah, well. Yeah, like you said, nothing lasts forever.
That's right. So view it as an opportunity. And one more thing before we go, which is just to say a bunch of new betas dropped. And while the Mac beta, I think, is developer beta, is not ready for prime time, I had terrible trouble with it. They're doing things to the sound subsystem, which I think are going to be good. Your long requested feature to do output to stereo HomePod.
Yes.
Seems to finally have happened.
I wonder, you know, I always wonder when I harp on about these things how much attention it gets, and I'm sure I'm not the only person who complained about it. But
no, and it didn't support AirPlay 2, and it seems like in my brief time using it, it seems like they are doing some serious changes to the way that the sound subsystem works, which I fear actually that it may break all of our other sound tools.
Right.
But
yeah.
But they know that like proper AirPlay support, AirPlay 2 support, being able to use those HomePods and some other stuff that's been weird in Big Sur in terms of audio, that they're trying to address them. So that's good, but I don't recommend anybody jump to that, because I reverted after about 2 hours, because I ended up not being able to play sound at all to anywhere, and a bunch of apps didn't launch, and it was very bad. So I backed out of it. However, I will say that iOS and watchOS betas have been stable for me, and I jumped to them so that I could test out Watch Mask Unlock. And funny, just coincidence, because I very rarely go outside the house, but I went to get my, we had some stuff serviced on one of our cars, and so I went to the dealership, and I got my mask on, and I'm standing there waiting for them to process the forms, and I flip up the iPhone, not even thinking that I had installed this the day before, and my watch taps me on the wrist, and it opens. I'm like, that's,
I was trying to test it out this morning, since I installed the public beta yesterday of both of these, and I'm impressed about, I was trying to remember how it worked, and I was impressed to realize the amount of engineering they put into the fact that it really, it requires you to be wearing a mask. Like, I tried to, like, burrow into, like, my sweatshirt, right? Like, it was a mask, and it's like, no. I actually had to go get a mask, put it on, and be like, oh, yeah, now it totally works.
No, it's recognizing that you're wearing a mask.
I was very impressed
with
that.
Yeah.
I was very impressed with the work that they've done with that. I think it's a great stopgap solution for, you know, the situation we're in right now is not a situation we will be in for the rest of our lives, cross our fingers, knock on wood, et cetera, et cetera. And obviously making changes on a software front is way faster than making changes on a hardware front. So everyone's like, ah, under the screen, Touch ID. It's like, that might be great. And I can see why there are occasions where that might be useful, but they're not going to be able to build a phone in the time that will be useful. It just, it will not happen. So I'm glad that they decided to come up with another methodology for dealing with that. And it's one that, you know, for everybody who owns an Apple Watch, you're basically all set. You don't have to do anything other than flip a switch. I think that's great. And that's the kind of stuff that I'd like to see them doing, is responding rapidly to the way that people are dealing with this problem and figuring out ways to sort of work around it.
Yeah, I wish it had come sooner, but I also appreciate that doing something like this is a tough task, and Apple wanted to do it right and not open security holes and do the work to train it on masks. And Gruber was saying that part of the challenge is that you've got the authentication flow can run either direction, which is tricky, right?
Yeah, because, this is what I said weeks ago on The Rebound. Somebody asked this question, like, wouldn't it be cool if you could use your watch to unlock your phone? I'm like, but you already use your phone to unlock your watch. You're creating an Ouroboros situation.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. But that's that all said, it works. And also occasionally, I noticed that occasionally it asks for your password, because it's like, all right.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, I don't feel like you're authentic yet. So it asks for your password occasionally. And I can't figure out whether that's because of a time delay or what exactly is going on there.
Jason, but sometimes my phone wants my password and I'm not sure why.
I know. So then I entered the password in one time, and then, but after that, then it's solid for the whole time that I'm using it. So
I had this, actually, totally side note, but like I started, I have this old radio on my bedside table, and it's actually a iPod dock unit that was one of the many I reviewed in my time at Macworld. But it's a really nice one from Cambridge Soundworks. It's got great sound. I don't use the dock part, but I just use it as a radio and a clock. Except the LCD display on it has basically is dying to the point where all of the digits in certain numbers light up. Like, all the lights are wrong, so, like, it's illuminating, like, you know, it'll show you, like, 8000, right? Like, and so I wasn't worried about it. It's like, I just use the radio. It's fine. I can sort of figure out things. And then I tried to set an alarm and realized I can't tell what time I'm setting the alarm for. Mm. I mean, I could, because I could go to where the AM, PM thing switches and then count, but I'm like, this is dumb. Uh-huh. So I was like, all right, maybe I can just find a way to duplicate the workflow, which is I want to wake up to the radio. And so what I did was, we have one of those IKEA Sonos speakers in the bedroom.
Right.
And so I made a shortcut that says at 7 o'clock in the morning, start playing to the speaker, start like streaming the news station. Cause you can tell it to stream stuff that's in iTunes or in the music app and, you know, do that. Great. But I noticed that I think what happened at one point was either I did something before falling asleep, or in its one of its mystical ways, the iPhone did the thing where it started wanting my passcode. And I don't think it didn't run the shortcut because I was not authenticated, which is annoying, because that's not what you want from your alarm clock behavior. It's like, oh, not sure it's you. I'm not going to wake you up. So that was a bit of a bummer when I realized that. But it's like that's a once in a blue moon situation, and right now it's not the most critical thing.
Can you set that as a home automation? You might be able to set that as a home automation based on time.
No,
because
you can't. Because your home automation doesn't do anything off the device.
You're right.
The other issue I have with that is like there is a shortcut action for setting a volume, but that volume is actually not the AirPlay volume. It's just the iPhone volume.
Oh.
So at some point I had turned that speaker up, and the next morning,
oh God,
it was extremely loud. And what's funny is, like, honestly, with that speaker, it's because it's so loud, I have it set to about 10% volume. So really anything about above like 30% volume is deafeningly
blaring,
startling in the morning. So yeah, I'm not sure why. That's a weirdness with AirPlay. It's like I wanted it to tell it to set the speaker volume, but because the speaker volume is controlled somewhat independently, it doesn't really know how to do that. So
maybe you need to buy a new clock radio.
Yeah, I toyed briefly with the idea of, like, I wonder if I could find an old one of these, pull out the LCD, and put the LCD in. But that seemed like too much. The problem, and then I just got very picky about what clock radio I liked, because this one is, I'm just very attached to this one. And then I realized Jason and I had literally become my dad, because he had done this exact same thing with his clock radio that he loved for years and, like, used until it was basically pieces were falling off. And I finally bought him a new one that was very close but not the same. And it took him like a year before he started using that one. I'm like, oh no, I'm him.
He needs to view the change as an opportunity, you see.
Exactly. Yes. Unfortunately, that's not really his style.
It's not anybody's style. You got to work on it.
Some more than others, though.
But yes, having a thing that you use, a physical tool that you use or appliance or whatever break, that is the ultimate in having your software discontinued, right? It's like, oh no, it doesn't work anymore. What'll I do? Like, yep, we brought it all the way back around, Dan.
That's right. Good on us.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Bye, Dan.
Bye, Jason.